This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov accused Belarusian opposition members who left the country during recent protests of seeking bloodshed, according to the RIA news agency on Sunday. His words come as tens of thousands of Belarusians joined an anti-government demonstration in central Minsk Sunday to protest President Alexander Lukashenko's claim to a sixth term in disputed elections. Waving red and white opposition flags, protesters demanded the president's resignation and chanted freedom in a gathering that local media reported had amassed crowds of more than 100,000. The EU has rejected the results of the election and has vowed to sanction Belarusians responsible for ballot fraud and a police crackdown that saw nearly 7,000 people arrested and sparked gruesome allegations of torture and abuse in police custody. Two people were killed in clashes in Ivory Coast that erupted between rivals armed with clubs and machetes after President Alassane Ouattara was chosen to run for a controversial third term, local sources said Sunday. Young opposition supporters on Saturday took to the streets in several towns and cities, especially the southern cocoa-growing hub of Divo, after the president accepted his party's nomination for the October poll. A dusk-to-dawn curfew has been imposed in Divo, where a bus station, bars, and shops were set on fire and looted in inter-ethnic violence. A hospital source in Divo said one person had succumbed to their injuries and that several more had been badly wounded. Other sources say the body of a teenager was found who was killed in a local bar. For more on these and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. United States-led international coalition troops withdrew from Iraq's Taji military base Sunday and handed it over to Iraqi security forces, witnesses and the coalition said. The base, which is 20 kilometers north of Baghdad, had been the site of frequent rocket attacks by Iran-backed militias targeting U.S.-led troops in recent months. The coalition said in a statement that, quote, "The movement of coalition military personnel is part of a long-range plan coordinated with the government of Iraq," end quote, and added that the camp has historically held up to 2,000 coalition members, most of whom have departed this summer. Remaining coalition troops are set to depart in the coming days. The withdrawal came days after U.S. President Donald Trump redoubled his promise to withdraw the few U.S. troops still in the country. Video app TikTok is saying it will challenge in court a Trump administration crackdown on the popular Chinese-owned platform, which Washington accuses of being a national security threat. As tensions soar between the world's two biggest economies, China and the U.S., President Donald Trump signed an executive order on August 6, giving Americans 45 days to stop doing business with TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance, effectively setting a deadline for a potential pressured sale of the app to a U.S. company. TikTok said in a statement, quote, "To ensure that the rule of law is not discarded and that our company and users are treated fairly, we have no choice but to challenge the executive order through the judicial system," end quote. ByteDance said in a separate statement that the suit would be filed on Monday, U.S. time. TikTok's feeds of short clips feature everything from dance routines and hair dye tutorials to jokes about politics. It's been downloaded 175 million times in the U.S. and more than a billion times around the world. Trump claims TikTok could be used by China to track the locations of federal employees, build dossiers and people for blackmail, and conduct corporate espionage. The company said it has never provided any U.S. user data to the Chinese government, and Beijing has blasted Trump's crackdown as political. Meantime, some U.S.-backed users of WeChat are suing President Trump in a bid to block an executive order that they say would effectively prohibit U.S. access to this popular Chinese messaging app. The complaint filed in San Francisco asked a federal court judge to stop Trump's order from being enforced. It was brought by the nonprofit U.S. WeChat Users Alliance and others who say their use of the app is mandatory. They say they aren't affiliated with the company. For more on these and other stories, please check out our website. This is Laurel Bowman for VOA News via remote.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Ouattara has a reputation outside the country, a reputation of a Democrat. So we expect him to understand that this country must continue to create conditions of a democratic building. That is what we are trying to do, and we will succeed, whether he wants or no.
Ivory Coast opposition Ivorian Popular Front rejected the decision to prevent former President Laurent Gbagbo from competing in the upcoming elections.
We have a lot of different platforms in place that are to ensure that corruption, be it in the private sector or the public sector, is huge from the perspective of the individual or the citizen.
A non-partisan Ghanaian group embarks on a campaign to combat corruption.
We see Americans as friends, and we see them as they should push for elections in Libya under international observation. That's the only solution.
And an advisor to General Khalifa Haftar expresses doubt that a ceasefire will hold in the western part of Libya. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A leading member of Ivory Coast opposition Ivorian Popular Front or FPI party has rejected as unfair a decision by election authorities banning former President Laurent Gbagbo and Guillaume Soro from participating in the upcoming October elections. Jean-Gervais Chide, FPI Vice President for Finance and Budget, says the reason behind the decision to prevent the former president from challenging incumbent President Alassane Ouattara in the elections is clearly political. He also says supporters of opposition groups plan on carrying out protests to reject the decision to ban the two opposition figures. Jean-Gervais Chiede tells me that the opposition will use all legal means to prevent the president from running for another term.
My reaction, and also as a friend, but also as a member of his party, my reaction is that this is not fair. This is not democratic. The commission has no right to ban their names. And the reasons they give are political reasons, in my opinion. And we know that the commission has rejected their request against the first banning. Now, there is one solution left to them, and their lawyers are trying to give another request to the Constitutional Council next week. That is something that they have to do. But as politicians, as a members of his political party,
Mr. Chidi, some Ivorians are saying that it appears that the move to ban former President Laurent Gbagbo and Guillaume Soro is a way for the incumbent president to prevent his opponent from competing against him. Is this what your position is, or the stance of your party is?
Yes, exactly. We understand, and it is clear for everybody, there's no doubt about that Mr. Ouattara, the president, who is himself seeking for a third term, in fact, is not keen on competing with Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Soro and other people. So he's trying to prevent them from competing.
So what are you going to do about this? Is there a recourse for you to take in order to reverse the decision of the Electoral Commission to allow the former president to compete?
Well, as a party, we have two ways. Mr. Gbagbo's lawyer will continue with another request to the Constitutional Council. But as a party, we will go on with the political way. I mean that we have already started organizing demonstrations in the country to protest against Mr. Ouattara's will to run for the third term, which is not allowed by the Constitution. And now, not only he's seeking a third term, violating the Constitution that way, but he's trying to prevent his opponent from competing. So we will continue to demonstrate democratically until he understands that he has no right to create trouble and clashes in the country.
The government came out banning all protests until September. Wouldn't this affect your plans to push back against the decision of the Electoral Commission to prevent former President Laurent Gbagbo from competing?
The first thing I have to say is that the government has made a decision according to which protests in the streets are forbidden until the 15th of September. But at the same time, even today, Saturday, the 22nd of August, the ruling party has organized demonstrations in the streets of Abidjan and other cities of the country. So the governor himself is violating his own rule. Also, the government says that rallies are not forbidden. So we can continue with rallies, but continue also with demonstrations democratically. Anyway, what everybody has to understand is that today there is an issue in the country. Yes or no, Mr. Ouattara has the right to run for the third term. We say no. His supporters say yes. Now, why they are demonstrating to say yes, why we should be forbidden from demonstrating to say no? Why? The Constitution gives us the same right to express our opinion democratically whenever we have different opinions. So we are Democrats, and Mr. Ouattara has a reputation abroad, outside the country, a reputation of a Democrat. So we expect him to understand that this country must continue to create conditions of a democratic building. That is what we are trying to do, and we will succeed, whether he wants or no.
Jean-Gervais Tshiede is a leading member of Ivory Coast Opposition Ivorian Popular Front, or FPI. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. The Ghana Integrity Initiative, or GII, has launched a series of programs to subject to scrutiny promises by political parties to fight corruption as outlined in their respective manifestos in the run-up to the December 7 general election. The group did this by compiling the views of citizens about their expectations on how they want the political parties to combat public corruption. Established in 1999, the Ghana Integrity Initiative, which focuses on fighting corruption, is a non-political organization. It is also the Ghana chapter of Transparency International. To learn more about the efforts of the group to help weed out corruption, I reach Mary Awelana Ada, a programs manager at the Ghana Integrity Initiative.
For us, that is the team we work on, and so we couldn't have done any other but to elicit citizens' voices when it comes to the anti-corruption struggle. So we are looking at what exactly they would want to see when it comes to anti-corruption. And so the data we captured is informed by legislation and also looking at policy implementation when we see the political parties come into power. And so all the voices I talked about are those that were captured in the citizens' manifesto that I'm talking about. So it's in relation to anti-corruption policy and practice. Should they be elected into power, or those we want to see in their manifestos and those we would want to see?
For those who come up with policies about the need to fight corruption, how do you hold them accountable to keep their promises in their manifesto? Because we've seen different political parties come into government, yet when they come to government, there are all kinds of allegations of corruption and all that. How do you subject them to scrutiny if they come to power and they fail, or they are unable to tackle corruption as they promised before the elections?
Thank you very much. So one of the things we have done is to also track promises that have been made, and when they have power, how they are implemented. And so some civil society organizations who are into anti-corruption, and I would mention the coalition that we belong to, have done some of this in the past. And we are currently tracking this government's implementation of the various promises they made when it comes to the issues around anti-corruption. And if you have followed the policies in Ghana, you realize that other civil society organizations have done the same. And we are particularly excited about the fact that this government has a Ministry of Monitoring and Evaluation. And so they are also capturing data. So we have the opportunity to then cross-reference the notes that we have taken, comparing them with what they are also taking. And I remember recently there has been a discourse around whether the percentages we are talking about are the same percentages they have also documented as implementation of their promises. So there is a mechanism for ensuring that we monitor the promises as against what has been implemented.
How is your organization educating Ghanaians about the need for integrity in public offices as well as in private businesses in the run-up to the election?
So we have a lot of sensitization and awareness programs in place as I speak. There is one which is supposed to be documenting abuse of incumbency and vote buying, electoral corruption as we speak about. And we have put in place several awareness creation programs that we are doing both regionally and also in the various constituencies. And then we have trained some very good journalists, investigative journalists, who are going to be documenting instances of abuse of incumbency and instances of electoral corruption, so that in the end we are compiling this report to take the process forward, looking at what do we do after the elections from the evidences we have captured in the field. Apart from that, we've also created opportunities for citizens to report corruption and wrongdoing when they see it. And so we have platforms that we have put in place, where one is the Transparency International Initiative that we refer to as the Advocacy and Legal Advice Center, which provides citizens the avenue to report instances of wrongdoing. And then we have legal expertise in-house who then pick up the issues and then we follow up for them. So we have a lot of different platforms in place that are to ensure that corruption, be it in the private sector or the public sector, is eschewed from the perspective of the individual or the citizen. And we have various private sector initiatives as well in place. We call one the Business Integrity Forums that we hold with private sector agencies.
Mary Awilana Ada is a programs manager at the Ghana Integrity Initiative. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Gabon's main opposition leader says the health challenges facing President Ali Bongo Ondimba are undermining effective governance of the country. Jean Ping, a diplomat and former chairperson of the African Union Commission, says he is working with the international community to help resolve rising tensions, which he says could plunge the country into chaos. Bing says he remains the only alternative to help Gabon realize its potential after what he says has been 60 years of misrule. But supporters of the government dismissed Bing's criticism as unpatriotic. They also dismissed his call for a new leadership, saying the president's ill health should not be used to score cheap political points. Jean Ping tells me that the government has so far been unable to meet the aspirations of the people or improve their lives despite repeated promises.
It's 60 years since independence, as you know. This event is celebrated in very difficult national circumstances and in an international context full of uncertainties because of the devastating consequences of the coronavirus pandemic. It is clear that the whole nation is questioning its destiny. What have we done? along these 60 years. In the short term, Gabonese people are more than ever convinced of the end of the regime in power. The main event that makes people believing it is the incapacity to rule of the one who took the power by force in 2016. Ali Bongo's inability due to his serious health problems leads to illegitimacy, to nothing.
What do you say to supporters of the president, Ali Bongo Ondimba, that opposition groups, including yourself and other opposition leaders, are using his health condition to score cheap political points, to make his government unpopular, and to wrestle power from him? They say that is regrettably unfortunate and very unpatriotic. How do you respond to that?
I took stock of the past 4 years. I mainly work on the diplomatic level in order to prevent Gabon from civil war. Nevertheless, it seems to me not far from us if nothing is done. I mean that the civil war, independently of what have been done to prevent it, is not far from now, if everything is not done on due time.
So my question to you, Mr. Jinping, is, are you ruling out any possibility of dialogue with the government?
They never listen to what you are telling them. For 50 years, they have been continuing to cheat, to lose the election, and to pretend that they win it. They won it. How can you continue to speak with people like that? They have been bombarding my headquarters. They have been killing my partisans here and there. And the consequences of that is that the Gabonese people are fed up with them. And there is only one way to way out, is for them to accept a peaceful possession of the power. And then we can forgive them and convince people to rebuild the nation and the national unity.
What should be the aspiration of the people of Gabon in the months and a year ahead before the elections?
I don't think that we are going very soon to elections. Well, we want to liberate the country from the dictatorship and peacefully, as I have mentioned it before. And then, after the liberation of the country, we will build a very, very powerful democracy based on the rule of law and a modern democracy. I think that we are now in the 21st century. We cannot continue to act as in the beginning of the independence, with a single party, with using intimidation. It's no more possible. We cannot enter to the history by going back.
Jinping, a diplomat and former chairperson of the African Union Commission, is the main opposition leader in Gabon. He spoke with me from the capital, Libreville. The international community, including the United Nations, have welcomed the latest ceasefire announced by rival groups in Libya. But analysts warn that there should be cautious optimism, since a recent ceasefire agreement in January did not help resolve the conflict. This despite reports that Libyans celebrated the announcement of the ceasefire. It was announced following reports of international pressure on the rival groups. This after concerns that the conflict could worsen because the warring factions were preparing for a battle over Sirte. Salah Eldin Abdel Karim al-Shukri is a legal advisor to Libya's National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar. He tells me that although General Haftar supports the ceasefire, his side will not negotiate with terrorists.
now with the issue of the ceasefire that is announced so many times by Sarraj so many times. But you know that Sarraj and his so-called government is not in control of the militias. Now we can see some rebellion of militias in Zawiya and in other places against Sarraj right now and against Bashaga. It cannot be implemented on the ground because Sarraj is not in control of the militias in the areas where he's supposed to be in control. Well, for us, we always the road of peace is always wanted. We have our doubts about what's going to happen in the eastern part, western part of Libya. First, we see the Turkish occupation on the ground and more of terrorists brought from northern Syria and from all over the place. Some of them are known terrorists wanted by a lot of security agencies in the world, including the United States agencies.
Is General Haftar committed to ceasefire to pave way for dialogue to resolve the conflict in Libya?
Marshal Haftar and the Libyan National Army is not seeking war. It's only seeking the freedom of the Libyan people from the threat of terrorism. This is all the goal of the Libyan armed forces, which is liberating Libya from this radical militias that's in control of Western Libya. That's all. You see, Marshal Haftar is not looking to seize power, but we are here in Benghazi. In particular, we are looking for a civilian state with elections and in control of the rule of democracy and the parties, and everyone can express their opinions with the free press and free commerce. And this is what we are seeking for. But in the other side, we have known terrorists like Muhammad Amari Zayed, which is in the council, the vice of Sarraj and the Minister of Education now. He is well-known member of Al-Qaeda. How can we cease fire with those terrorists? How can we be in dialogue with these terrorists?
What is the motivation behind the declaration of ceasefire from your side?
For us, we don't trust them. The Libyan armed forces, they don't trust the terrorists. And they know that Sarraj is not in control of that area of part of Libya. And they are supported directly by the Erdogan government and the Qatari government. Each militia gets its support directly from those governments.
But what do you think is the best way to resolve the current situation? And if dialogue, as you said, you will not sit down with terrorists and negotiate with them, then what is the next step forward to resolve the crisis?
I see the international community led by the Americans to force elections in all areas of Libya and under their observation and the judicial system observation and give the Libyan people voice to choose their leadership. Whatever the Libyan people will choose should be recognized by the world. It's the only way to solve this problem either. And the international community should support us in dismantling the militias all over Libya and withdrawing arms from the streets and destroying them and having national reconciliation under international community with the aid of the American government as the superpower that's in control of at least the Middle East and the Mediterranean. We see Americans as friends, and we see them as they should push for elections in Libya under international observation. That's the only solution.
Salah Eldin Abdul Karim Al-Shukri is a legal advisor to Libya's National Army led by General Khalifa Haftar. He spoke with me from Benghazi, Libya.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from African Collection. But first, the spokesperson for the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, says the group is stepping up preparation efforts for the upcoming October general election. Tumaini Makeni says Tundu Lissu, the party's presidential candidate, is generating support among the youth and the elderly, which he says boosts the prospect of the party before the elections. He also says talks aim to form an alliance with ACT Wazalendo is at an advanced stage. Analysts say an alliance gives opposition party the best shot at defeating incumbent President John Magufuli. The ruling party has dominated Tanzania since the country gained independence. But main opposition spokesperson Tumaini Makeni tells me that there's growing evidence that if the October elections are transparent and credible, Chadema will defeat the ruling party.
Yes, for sure. Political parties are putting up a lot of efforts, gearing up for the upcoming general election. Chadema included, as the main opposition party in Tanzania. We are putting a lot of efforts now. We are putting a lot of mobilizations in terms of resources. All what it takes to win, Tanzanians are ready for the upcoming general election. You can see clearly the presidential candidates called it a tsunami of change will take place in this upcoming general election.
Tumaini, how has been the responses following your presidential candidate tour of some parts of the country in anticipation of the election?
Yes, for sure, because politically, Chama Cha Mapinduzi, the CCM is not there politically. If we go by all political dimensions, all political analysis, it's not as a political party is not there. For the first time, if I can give one a quick example, we are fielding members of parliament candidates and ward councillors in all wards and all constituencies across the country, which could be one of the very, very, very serious move to oust the CCM in power. So this time around, there's going to be a tsunami. And this has been shown all the way along on our presidential candidate tour, as I said earlier. There have been early warning signals that Tanzanians are ready again for this election.
How are negotiations between your party and ACT Wazalendo going so far? Because you have a limited window within which to announce an alliance before the October elections.
Yes, we understand that concern. That is a good question, Peter. We understand that concern. There's been a concern from different works of different people. Regarding our analysis, we think that could be the only political party that could be legitimate to form an alliance. We are moving good. The enacted law, political parties law, which does give some limitations for a formal coalition. So if that room will be limited, then you have to open another door, which, you know, you don't have to go with the formal coalition, but you just form some other arrangements for a coalition or other cooperation. The most important thing here is just to host CCM by any means necessary from all levels of the election, from the ward, from the constituents to the presidency. So we form differently, not necessarily a formal alliance, but later we have some sort of coalition. So we're moving on with the discussions. So far, the discussions are moving good. The particular time when everything will be fine and we'll be ready, we'll inform the public at large, even the international community, to know exactly how kind of coalition we're going to have between Chadema and the ACT Wazalendo.
Have you met the Electoral Commission, and are you confident that the upcoming election will be transparent and free?
It's another good question, and I hope, guys, that before you have time to ask the same question to the Electoral Commission itself. But on our side, we have been so much clear that this Electoral Commission is not independent, because the chairman of the Electoral Commission, the vice chairman, the CEO of the election, that is... the commissioners are all President Magufuli appointees. Magufuli also doubles to be a candidate for CCM. In that regard, the independence of the Electoral Commission is in question. But that won't stop people's choice, because this election is going to be decided by the people. So if that's going to be decided by the people, the election, then the people themselves will be the independent Electoral Commission. That will be in coin. When we saw there have been hindrances and limitations for those in power to have any place, an independent electoral commission, we decided that this election is going to be decided by the people. And they've been calling several times, it's not independent, but let the electoral commission, let every one of the participating political parties win or lose the election in the ballot box. No less, no more. Member of Parliament, whether it's at the President, let him or her win the ballot box, or let him or her lose the election in the ballot box.
Tumaini Makene is the spokesperson for the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. As South Africa continues to ease coronavirus restrictions, technical experts and public health experts are working on plans to protect the health of the 14 million South Africans who rely on a network of minibus taxis to get to work, school and more. Innovators and investors say this could be an African solution to a problem that affects millions of others in Africa and beyond. Viewers Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
The Humble Minibus Taxi is a lifeline for more than 70% of South Africa's workforce. The informally regulated system of vans, each seating about 14 passengers, is a mainstay in the nation's major cities and in its rural areas. But health experts worry this system is a breeding ground for coronavirus because of riders' close quarters and the high volume of passengers. A new South African nonprofit initiative, led by businessman Andile Ramaphosa, who is also the eldest son of President Cyril Ramaphosa, is trying to address this gap as the nation attempts to revive its economy after more than 9 weeks of strict lockdown, which started in March and has since eased off. He spoke to VOA via Google Hangouts.
Lockdown worked in this country in terms of reducing the spread of COVID. And it worked because people were not going anywhere. That was really great and allowed government to prepare and do all the things they needed to do. When we insisted as business and as South Africans, let's open this economy, by not dealing with the commute, we basically undid what was happening with lockdown. So if you deal with the transport sector, because COVID is a virus that moves through the transport sector, if you deal with that effectively, you can actually put in an artificial lockdown through it. So for us, we saw that. We said, great. Okay, so we need to come up with solutions.
HIV researcher Dr. Jenny Pfeiffer-Kutsia, founder and director of the African Potential Foundation, says her team has come up with several solutions, ranging from simple to complex.
What we're looking at is a system very similar to what's being used in ambulances, and that is to adapt a UVC air filter that allows the airflow to be encouraged within the taxi using various fans within the filter, and air passes through the filter where it's then irradiated within a matter of seconds and is then transferred back out into the taxi to be circulated out within the taxi.
Her team is also considering an alarm system that alerts passengers to open the windows to allow fresh air to circulate, sanitizing stations that passengers can use to clean their hands before boarding, and a divider between the driver and passengers. These measures, say Ramaphosa's team, could decrease the risk of infection by up to 80%. So far, SDI has fitted out 5,000 school transport taxis and 1,000 commuter taxis at an estimated cost of about $340,000, much of it provided by donors. Andile Ramaphosa says it's been a steep learning curve, but a worthwhile one.
It's been quite a journey of discovery for us non-scientists to bring all these people together with one thing in mind. We need our people to get to work safely, and we need to save lives.
Pfeiffer-Kutsia says the team is also looking at how to scale the model up to fit other African countries, which use similar transport systems to move millions of people each day. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has announced the resumption date for qualifiers of the African Cup of Nations Cameroon 2021 and the group stage of the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022. It's a busy schedule for the participating teams from November 2020 to November 2021 in the fight for spots in the final tournament of the two competitions. The schedules for these two competitions have had to be revised because of the COVID-19 outbreak, which halted many sporting activities across the continent for some time. For Cameroon 2021, the qualifiers resume on November 9th to 17th, 2020. The 40 teams in contention for the five slots, For Qatar 2022, will commence the journey between May 31st and June 15th, 2021. The playoffs matches have been scheduled for November 8th, 16th, 2021. A CAF statement says CAF is monitoring the situation closely and working with the relevant authorities with regards to hosting of the matches and will make decisions accordingly in the event of developments that will affect playing a match at the designated venue. Meanwhile, Foresters have been crowned the Seychelles Premier League champions for the first time after winning the 2019-2020 championship. They won their maiden league crown with 46 points in a season which was halted for 4 months since March and only resumed in July due to coronavirus pandemic. When the league resumed, 5 of the 12 teams decided to stay away from the completion of the competition as the Seychelles Football Federation made it optional for teams to participate. Foresters were in a strong position to win the league as they were ahead, though they faced a fierce challenge from the island's record league winners, St. Michel, which pulled out of the remainder of the league and left the door open for them to reach the summit. In another development, CAF has embarked on a project to develop the leagues across Africa in order to enhance the organizational structure and economic sustainability of the domestic competitions. With the assistance of UEFA, the project dubbed CAF UEFA Assist League Development Program aims to support member associations to professionalize their leagues and clubs' development by providing long-term development for football. The program, a partnership between the two confederations, will promote dialogue with key stakeholders and support member associations with skills and techniques for standardized measures to guarantee the sustainability of domestic football leagues. Set to kick off in September 2020, Ghana and Rwanda have been selected for the pilot project of the CAF UEFA Assist League Development Program. Launched in 2017, the UEFA Assist Program seeks to provide assistance to other confederations and their member associations in order to develop and strengthen football across the globe. In athletics, Britain's Mo Farah will be the pace setter for the elite men's race at October's scheduled London Marathon. The 37-year-old Farah is among the competitors to have achieved the Olympic qualifying time of 2 hours, 11 minutes and 30 seconds. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge, who won last year's event, leads the men's field with Kenenisha Bekele of Ethiopia. Reduced fields of 30 to 40 athletes will also compete for the elite women's and wheelchair titles on October 4th. Ethiopia's Mosnet Garemiu and Mule Mashun, who finished runner-up and third respectively in 2019, are among 8 athletes who have run marathons in under 2 hours 5 minutes. Bridget Kosgei of Kenya heads up the women's elite field alongside compatriot and world champion Ruth Cheptengich, Ethiopia's Rosa Dereje, and Kenya's Vivian Cheruiyot, Vale Jamela, and Egitu Azmerano are the other picks of the lineup. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Tamu anailamba. Mama. Baby, anu nani kosha, kwenzi samhadara naropoka, uniosha kama nikichafuka, hiyo kose kama nikidondosha, yani inama inuka.
Show them, feel like to feel your body like a plague. Then I'm a name, I'm a jungle, I'm a yoga. Your boy, your paint, I'm a speaker for Karanti. Message you.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if the needle doesn't pass, the thread doesn't follow. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.